is us like learning in public and like trying to
literally learning in public.
Yeah.
We were at Vancouver Public Library.
Yes.
There are glass doors.
Yes.
We are literally learning in public.
Pulling back the curtain of silence.
And learning what freedom feels like. I'm Nick.
And I'm Lala. This is Seen. Brown-eyed activism.
Healing at the intersections.
So it's been a couple of weeks since our last conversation. Wanted to check in and ask you how you're doing. We've talked, obviously, a lot in the last 2 weeks, but I think everyone who's listening last time would want to know how you're doing.
This is like the worst day to ask me how I'm doing, I feel like.
Yeah.
My mom's a nurse and she works in long-term care, and her hospital has a COVID outbreak now, and she tested negative for COVID over the weekend, so like a week ago, let's say. But now she has symptoms that she got retested, so it's just been like really stressful because we don't live in the same like household, and she moved my youngest sister to be with my oldest sister for this exact reason, like back in March, and she was really excited to like have my youngest sister come back home. And then this happens, and it's just been like a big gut punch to not just our family, of course, like all the other healthcare workers whose families are now exposed. So I'm like feeling really emotional today. Plus it's raining outside, which matches my energy. It's like summer solstice, doesn't feel like it. I don't know about you. And then I think like in general, I've just been feeling really angry at the level of, I don't know if the word, yeah, I just feel like there's a lot of people that are making big risks, right? Taking big risks and putting themselves on the line, in this movement to ensure that Black life exists still, despite so many, systems of violence and oppression against Black folks and other people of color and Indigenous folks. But I've been noticing this trend of just watching Black femmes put themselves on the line in major ways. People locally, like shout out to the really courageous Black femmes in this city who are just doing the literal most to educate folks, to call oppression out and name it, to put their bodies on the line, to get arrested, to become, you know, villainized or vilified. And then also with my own family, with my mom, like she's a Black woman who's putting her health on the line to like take care of other people's family members, and to witness the level of, I guess, just like people have moved on with their life in both situations. People don't think that this issue with Black Lives Matter affects them, so they've just now resigned to be posting whatever selfies, and like I've unfollowed you accordingly. Like I'm just like I'm done, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then when it comes to this fight against this disease that no one seems to know how to manage, it also is just striking me even more in those spaces. And so like my mom is putting her health on the line to see people like carrying on. It's just, it's so frustrating and it's so exhausting. And so I'm not mad. And I'm still mad. Like I'm still pissed. I'm still feeling, you know, really big feelings about just the level of disconnect that I feel people are having. And I don't want to say that, you know, shout out to people who are doing the work. I just don't want to big up people for now doing the bare minimum that you should have been doing your whole life. So it's like, keep going. But for the rest of you, it's like, yeah, it's like, we really see that. Like, I really see what people aren't doing. So
thank you for being transparent about it. I think it's really important. And of course, sending all of the love and healing energy and prayers to your mom. I hope that she tests negative again. And either way, I hope really speedy recovery for her. And yeah, I think what you're saying it perfectly captures, there's no escape, right? It's like this affects every aspect of your life. And also it's dealing with all this stuff on top of, you know, normal life stuff. It's not like
I just started a new job, like, yeah, in the middle of a pandemic and everyone's like, how are you doing? And I'm like, what do you want to know? Mm-hmm. You know, for the people that are late to the party who are now just checking up on me and asking me how I am. Mm-hmm. We don't do Cole's notes over here. We just, I can't give you brevity. So I just can't respond to that question. Like,
yeah, absolutely. And I've been feeling what you're talking about too, about the sort of moving on energy where it felt like there was a much more broad focus on Black lives and what was happening, anti-Black violence, for a while. And there's still some, but I feel that sort of general energy of people going back to, you know, quote unquote normal. And it's obviously really upsetting and alarming. And when I was thinking about what I wanted to talk about today, what I wanted to do this episode on, I was just thinking about all of those of us who aren't moving on, who don't want to move on, and who can't move on. And I really wanted to explore what I think is maybe really the most important foundation for our movements together, which is what it looks like and what it would feel like to build solidarity between the news cycles. Mm. Because when the horrible things happen and we're having to react, it's important for us to show up. It's important for everybody to show up, whether they've been there or not. But the best work is done by people who are in deep relationship with each other and who really have already a strong foundation to work together. And our movement work is always going to be the most effective when we're not just reactive, but we're also building and dreaming and imagining and all of those things on our own in between the news cycles. So I just really wanted for us, the two of us today, to dream and imagine what could be possible for communities that we're a part of and other communities that we really want to be close with and build with. What could that look like? Movement building or solidarity building from a place of love and care and all of the things that, you know, will help us show up for each other when things are at their worst, but also is so much deeper than that.
Mm. I'm really excited to have this conversation. I feel like there was a part of me, like this morning especially, I was like, how am I supposed to get on a podcast and like talk about hopeful shit? And I'm like, that's actually what I need the most. Mm-hmm. It feels, I don't know, I think a lot of us have been in a deep sort of awakening to, for some of us, we've been awakened. For some of, for others of us, I feel like we've been like, our oppression is really out there for people to see. And I think there's been a lot of like trying to cocoon and like hold ourselves close. And I feel like for myself, when I'm so focused on just taking care of myself on the day to day, it can feel like a frivolous thing to try to find joy or like even see a way out that is centered on care and love and all those things that you're describing. So yeah, I'm really looking forward to this episode and talking to you about sort of like what you imagine. I'd love to like share some of the things that I think are required in this new world that we're trying to create together, because like you and I are friends and I've always been blessed to have other people of color around me my whole life. But I think in the same conversation that we had last week or last episode, when we're like, if we're feeling a type of way, we need to go deeper. Yeah. I would just like love to talk about what I'm witnessing other like non-Black people of color share and how mm-hmm. they're kind of coming to the conversation in ways that I think is really helpful, and in other ways that I'm like, so yeah.
speaking of things that are, you know, required, I wanted to start with what I believe is the foundation of everything. And I think it'll come up throughout the episode because, again, like, it's just, it has to be interwoven through every piece of this. But for me, the biggest, most basic thing is respecting each other's boundaries. So we want to be close and we want to develop deep relationships. And in order to do that in a way that's safe and healthy and is actually supportive for everybody, we have to respect each other's boundaries. So that means listening to each other, finding out how someone else wants to be treated, not how we think they should want to be treated or how we maybe assume they would want to be treated based on, you know, what maybe another member of their group feels or what we assume from, you know, media or whatever else. It's really being able to tune into each other and ask and find out what feels okay for you.
Mm-hmm. No, I love that. I was actually going to say, as you were talking about, like, the one thing that you think is foundational, I wanted to interject and be like, let's say what we think on the count of three, because I wanted to say something else. And because you said boundaries, and I was going to say trust, which, ooh, I think is, like, interwoven in the concept of, like, boundaries and care. Because if I'm, you know, checking up on you and asking you, hey, how can I be there for you? Hey, how are you feeling today? If I do that, let's say you don't know me and I'm just like a new friend and I keep on doing that, you're going to be like, oh, she cares. She's asking about how, like, what my needs are. She's knowing that, like, she might not know. She's not, might not be the arbiter of my experience. And that builds trust. That means, like, over, you know, maybe by the 10th time I've been, like, checking up on you, you're like, I could trust this chick. This bitch is cool. Like, you know, like, those things are so foundational in, like, relationship building is. And I actually wanted to ask you that, because you mentioned not assuming what,
yeah,
people need. Why did you say that? Or, like, why is that important to you?
I think I said that mostly I'm thinking about among non-Black people, how sometimes, I mean, you probably have these conversations too. It's just as a non-Black person, mm-hmm, this is my experience, mm-hmm, where, you know, I'll sometimes maybe correct somebody, be like, oh, actually, like, that's not cool for us to say as non-Black people. And somebody will say back, oh, well, my friend is Black and they don't care. And I'm like, okay, well, I mean, there's literally, like, tens of millions of Black people who don't want you to do that. If that means literally anything to you, like, first of all, your friend maybe just isn't telling you they hate it. Second of all, right, your friend might
not feel safe or comfortable. Like, exactly, there's many reasons why somebody's not correcting you.
Yeah, and maybe you have a, like, unique relationship with that person. And maybe your friend has bad politics. Like, not every Black person has great politics.
Yes, yes. There's Dr. Umars everywhere, you know what I'm saying? Like,
yes, but yes. But either way, I mean, somebody might be comfortable with something in one setting, and that doesn't mean that you should just blanket do that all the time with any given person, you, right, know? I'm sure there's things that I, you know, really hate that maybe somebody else's, like, queer friend might be cool with. That doesn't mean you can say that to me, right? Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And I think to that point, it's, like, about affording people dignity to, like,
yeah,
be like, actually, that's not the way I like to be addressed. Actually, that's not the way that I like to be treated. It's, like, again, so foundational. It is, like, boundaries, trust, like, those two things, I think they're, like, sisters.
I agree, because I think setting boundaries and having them honored is such an important part of how we build trust, yeah, with each other.
Exactly.
Right? If I say, this isn't okay with me, or, you know, I really do want this, or I really don't want that, if you respect that and listen and adjust your behavior accordingly, I'm learning that I can trust you, yeah, that it's safe to be with you, because when something isn't okay for me, you care about that and you respect it. And that matters more to you than whatever your personal agenda is.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes.
So that's, like, earning closeness.
Yeah.
It's, like, so often people, they'll get offended by boundaries and be like, but I'm trying to be close to you. It's like, well, earn it.
Dude, I told you this story. I'm going to tell people because this is wild to me. So over the, like, a couple days ago, Nolan and I were, like, walking. Oh. We went to go pick up a couple of beers at a local brewery. Oh, my God. This is wild to me. Ugh.
Yeah.
It gets me fucking, ugh, heated, man.
Yes.
And I went in to go get some stuff because he didn't have his wallet. And I was like, I have mine. So I went to go pick up the beers, came outside, and he was talking to a person that he knew who works there. And this person was talking like quite close to him. Like I came out and was like, this is kind of weird. Like I haven't seen anyone talk this closely to my partner in, like since months. Since March. And then I pulled up and he was like, didn't create space still. And then like chatting some more. And then at the end, he like walked in for a hug and was like, ha ha ha. Like, it's not that big of a deal. Like, oh, and like acknowledged that it was a taboo thing to do,
crossing
a boundary, but still did it anyways. And both of us were so stunned. Like, I haven't hugged my mom since March. And some cishet white dude is like, bring her here. Fuck Corona, right? Ooh. It doesn't even matter. I was like, I told Nolan, I'm like, the next time I see any one of your little friends, like, I'm kicking your friend. No, that's wild to me. Like, I don't, literally don't know you. I don't care if you have the best of intentions. He gave us a bunch of free beer. So we were like,
but that doesn't make it okay.
Exchange. Like, I'm potentially exposed to whatever the hell you've been doing. And if you've been if you're hugging me, who you haven't seen in like 6 months, you hugging everybody. Like,
yeah, which is horrifying. And I actually think that's a really important point. Just because you're doing something for somebody or you are trying to, you have a good intention for somebody, that doesn't give you the license to cross their boundaries.
Snaps to that, like, sister.
That is so relevant to the racial justice movement, honestly.
Well,
because there's so many.
I was going to say, sorry to cut you off. I was going to say, I think it's relevant in so many ways because it's like, well, I'm showing up for you. Like, I'm here for you. So therefore you owe me. Like, I can cross this boundary. And it's like, that's manipulative. You are doing something. So, and I think part of the like building trust and care is offering it freely without strings attached.
Oh my God.
You can't, you know what I mean? Like, it can't be such that your solidarity is rooted in it's the foundations of it are like you owe me now.
Yeah, so it's like, I'm doing this thing for you, so therefore I am entitled to harm you. Like, sorry, that's abuse.
Yes,
That's not allyship.
Exactly.
But wild that people think that.
And I think the important part about this conversation that we're having in general is that even in like the circles where we think we're all on the same page, that's not necessarily the case. Like, even in social justice circles, even in quote-unquote progressive spaces, like, harm is still happening, right? We have to actively be working on how we can minimize harm and mitigate like that type of fuckery even in those spaces. And I think so many of us have been let down in those spaces because we've been like, and we've almost gaslit ourselves because you're like, well, it can't be like this. Like, we're all fighting, you know, to end homelessness together. We're all been part of the anti-poverty movement. I can't accept that this person would be that way. No, it must be me. And it's like, no, that person can still embody toxicity, patriarchy, like all the things, and be the face of a movement or be, you know, in leadership positions. Those things can exist. Like, we always talk about chewing gum and walking, and like, this is it, you know? Like, we need to be really real with ourselves.
Yes, because it's so much easier to sort of intellectually have good politics or to care about specific things when it's convenient to you than it is to actually interrogate your own ways of being in the world. And also, there is a big, I think power is very loud here, right? Because people are in positions of power either, you know, socially belonging to dominant groups or in, you know, if they're a leader of a movement or things like that, that's when power comes in. And I think as humans, we obviously have a very dysfunctional relationship with power. And so for a lot of people, that means wielding power in a way that's harmful to others. And intentionally, unintentionally, whatever, the point is, it's very difficult for people to work through that and to figure out what are the ways that my relationship to power has become dysfunctional and what effect is that having. So to work through that on a personal level, that's a kind of work that not a lot of people are doing. And that's, I think, why harm is so rampant, even on the left or even in groups that are supposedly humanitarian or whatever.
Absolutely.
You want to call it.
Yeah. I mean, look at the example with Sean King.
Oh, God.
I mean, there's lots of examples with Sean King.
Oh, yeah.
Right? But I think the most important takeaway from what I have seen a lot of Black femmes, a lot of Black non-binary folks, like, openly say is that the way in which he goes about his activism is such that it replicates the same harm that he's saying that he's fighting against.
Absolutely.
With the people that he's supposed to be working with or collaborating with, or, you know what I mean? It's like, this shit is so insidious. Like,
and I just want to, like, I wish we had, like, Desus and Miro's graphics.
Allegedly,
young queer Black people for daring to speak out about problems that they have with his activism, or, like, very real harms that he allegedly has perpetrated. So the next part of building solidarity that I want to talk about is listening to each other. And of course, that's, like, you know, I think all of these things are things that people say. I'm just hoping we can get maybe a little bit deeper into it, because I want us to be showing the level of interest in each other that we show for our own. You know, being just as invested. And not just, again, like, not just in the moments of crisis or suffering. It's like, I love reading novels. I love TV. So for me,
you're a media bitch. You just want to take it all in.
Yes, I do.
Do you see this tweet?
So
do you see this
right now?
Do you see this word? Do you see like, bitch, I can't see it all. But that's one of the reasons that I love you, is like, we both are kind of like obsessed with things that people are creating. So we're like, oh my God, watch this.
Put exactly.
Saweetie's music video. And she's
just exactly. Oh, she has a new song that reminds me.
Tap in.
Is it amazing?
It's amazing. It's to the beat of Blow the Whistle.
What? Oh my God. Yeah, okay. Like, I was just like listening to the new Beyonce song on repeat last night. So I saw that there was a new Saweetie song and I was like, oh, I want to listen to it, but I can't. I'm on repeat.
It's so good. I've just been mixing that up with Ungodly Hour. If you don't know.
Oh God.
If you don't know about Chloe and Halle, like, what are you doing? Anyway, sorry.
I also did listen to Ungodly Hour last night, because
I've listened to the album like seven times.
I listened to it multiple times per day. It's perfect. Yes. Anyways, we're getting off topic. Yes. Or we're not, actually, because this is kind of the point. I think, so for me, it's really important to be reading novels by Indigenous authors, by Korean authors, by Latinx authors, Black authors, like everybody. Mm-hmm. Like, I want to hear everybody's stories and culture through their own voice, their own eyes. And I think so often people are kind of focused on media that represents them, which I understand, especially for, you know, BIPOC, for people who grew up without a lot of representations of ourselves in media. But I think, again, really showing up for each other, we need to learn about each other, and I think engaging in other people's stories as they tell them, that's one of the best ways to learn.
Yeah, no, I'm so
close.
I'm so with you. I mean, and I feel like that is one facet of my life where I'm like, I actually don't read much fiction. I don't read fiction at all. And you trifling, because you have like an e-reader and you don't give me books.
I mean, I've given you multiple hard copy books and then you keep them forever and don't read them.
That's a read. Okay, moving on. But what I was going to say, when you were talking about listening, one of the things that I wanted to bring up is listening to what people are saying, not how they're saying it. It's like, ooh, shit that we always talk about when we're talking about like white people, because the little tone police, but like, we do that to each other. We literally do that to each other. And it is so unhelpful. Like, get to the root of the message, as opposed to being like, say that shit nicer to me. You should be nicer to me because I'm also a person of color. Oh, you didn't like how I said this thing? Well, like, you should cut me some slack because no. You know?
Yeah. Did you see brown fragility trending on Twitter last night?
I did.
So I don't know how this started. Do you know how it started?
I don't know how it started, but I was really scared because I like found the hashtag. I was like on Twitter and I'm like, oh my God, like what's this gonna be? I don't know why I assumed the worst, but I was like, is somebody coming for brown people now? Because like, we don't need this shit. And then I was like reading through the tweets and I'm like, wow, like people are having this really great conversation about like how anti-blackness exists and colorism exists in brown communities. Like, this is an important That was what I took away from it.
Which, yes, it is important. And there were some great people saying that, which was amazing. But when I clicked into the hashtag, most of what I saw was brown people being like, are people saying that we can't, that we don't experience racism as brown people? Oh. Because, like, yeah, of course we should fight anti-blackness in our own communities, but, like, we experience racism too. And I was like,
right.
This
is,
I was like, you're complaining about the hashtag. Yeah, exactly.
You're telling,
like,
you're on
complaining
yourself,
about it. But when you say that, I'm like, do you not get that that's what white people do too? That's white fragility, being like, oh, are you saying that I haven't had a hard life just because I'm white? No, no,
hard.
That is not what anybody's saying.
It's the same thing. Exactly. So, in the conversation of brown fragility, it's like, I understand that you, Tremola, experience oppression because of the color of your skin, but you certainly don't,
anti-blackness.
Yeah, it's like anti-blackness is still like a thing that you are able to wield if you wanted to.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Or be benefited of, because, you know, it's like, I don't know. There's a part of me that's like, in the conversation of listen, and if we're trying to get deeper, we need to be able to, as I legitimately always say every motherfucking episode, chew gum and walk, hold the nuance. Like, we have to be able to be like, this and this and this and this. It can't just be like, we only have one thought in our head at once, and like, we have to like throw the thought out before we can make room for the other thought. Like, it's, oh God,
absolutely.
My mom is, oh God.
What?
She got her test results just now.
And?
Oh. Shit.
I'm so sorry.
Fuck. Sorry, can you hold on one sec?
Of course.
Can I just, Hey everyone, it's Nick.
And Lala.
If you've been listening to Scene and you like what you hear,
please share us with your friends.
Subscribe to the podcast.
Follow us on Instagram at Scene the Podcast.
Write a review and just tell us what you think.
And help make this work sustainable by supporting Scene the Podcast on Patreon.
We need our beautiful community and we cannot do this without you. Yeah. Sorry, my mom just texted our family group chat and it has COVID. So I'm a little bit rattled now. So anyways, we can keep doing this episode. I'll try my best.
Yeah. And we can stop any time.
Thanks.
It's, yeah, obviously the most important thing by far is your well-being.
Thanks.
And so. So, but yeah, I guess this is sort of like what it is right now, right? Is like all of these things happening and then trying to keep living your life while these things are happening, which is hard and just sort of what it's been like.
Yeah. It's like, it doesn't feel like it's a unique experience, but
yeah,
it's sadly still overwhelming as fuck, man.
Is there anything that would help, or do you want to just like try to jump back into the conversation?
We can just jump back into the conversation. Like, yeah. I talked to my mom like an hour ago, so I'll call her after this.
Yeah. I'm just going to do like a couple of heart breaths. Did we talk about this in another episode where it's like a deep breath and you draw in loving energy from the earth and source and you draw it into your heart, and then on the out breath you send it out to whoever you want to send care to. Mm-hmm. So I'm just gonna do a couple breaths and send them to you and your mom. Is that okay? So the other example of listening that I wanted to give was staying connected on social media, because that's a place where folks often will say things that maybe they don't feel safe to say in other places, or just in their most uncensored way because they're sitting in their bedroom like feeling really comfortable. But again, I wanted to like interweave boundaries back into this, because you know, like when we're engaging in the art and media that other people from other cultures or groups have created, we need to listen to how they want us to engage and like keep, you know, stay appropriate. Like some things aren't for us to have an opinion on mm-hmm. or engage in a certain way. And with social media as well, I think sometimes people will say, oh, it's in a public forum, so I should be able to just jump in with whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important, again, to, you know, really think about and respect, is this person saying this because they're trying to have a conversation with, you know, people outside of their group, or are they trying to, you know,
engage talk in a to dialogue. People
in their group yeah. or, yeah, or just like express themselves. And it's important to maybe respect what that intention is. And beyond that, if we get it wrong, just be able to take that in. Like, it's yeah. okay to have conflict. We yeah. don't have to be afraid of getting it wrong.
Yeah. Keep it moving with that as well. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that respect for boundaries piece on digital spaces is important. Because like you talked about in our episode on social media, it's like digital spaces are like extensions of real life. Like, you're not, yeah. just because you think you don't see that person who's saying that thing out there, you don't see them in front of you, doesn't mean that like you should be treating them any differently than you would say, like treat them face to face. So in spaces where, and this happens all the time when it comes to like black women, black femmes, putting things out there for ourselves to celebrate ourselves or to clap back at bullshit, and to see the insertion of other folks when it is visibly like requested that only people of that group are the ones who are welcome to like comment or respond or, you know, clap back or participate. I think it's like, if you're not even able to do that and practice that respect for boundaries online, then like you certainly won't be able to do that in real time.
Totally.
You know?
Absolutely. And then I just wanted to talk about sharing positive, generative, expansive space together. So creative spaces, like performances, or there is a wonderful arts therapist in expressive arts therapist in Vancouver who's my good friend Jyotika, and she's done these workshops for BIPOC only to facilitate art therapy. I haven't been able to attend one yet, but her work is so beautiful. I'm excited to one day hopefully get to go to one. And I think that kind of thing is so beautiful, to have BIPOC together doing something creative and, you know, expressive and connecting in that space. That's, I just think, so such an incredible kind of bond to be forming with each other.
Mm. Mm-hmm. That's cool. One thing that I was going to say in terms of like, I mentioned this at the outset of the episode. One thing that I've been noticing is the number of accounts that I follow on social media that have been sharing content specific to their own community in relation to what's happening in the Black Lives Matter mm-hmm. space in this movement. So I've noticed a lot of folks creating content for their, like, you know, Asian communities, specifically like talking about anti-blackness in like the Philippines, talking about anti-blackness in like the Vietnamese community, talking about anti-blackness in the Korean community, and like linking like historical like co-led movements in which we've like relied on each other or supported one another, and like talking about those things very plainly. I think that is back to the conversation of like trust and listening. That is, I think, like reading the content that Black folks are creating and then saying like, okay, like how does this apply, you know, mm-hmm. how does this apply to like me and my group? Like when folks are talking about the things like, you know, one example is just like the Civil Rights Act in the United States in 1964, and talking about like that significance. Yes, it was specifically about civil rights, and it was led predominantly, overwhelmingly by Black folks, but like the other folks that benefited, the other groups that benefited, were like so many other immigrant groups. And I think that sort of connecting the dots and expanding our ideas of what solidarity to our communities looks like instead of just like our own like internal communities, like you were saying, caring for each other beyond just like our own group. I think mm-hmm. when we are aware of that history, I think it's really powerful to show that we're not actually quote unquote like pioneers in building solidarity between Black and Asian groups. Like some of that had already existed. Some of our ancestors were already doing that work. And like that just bolsters the need for us to lean into that because it's historic and like that's history we were never really told, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. That also made me think of our friend Jane was really involved in during the Wet'suwet'en uprisings, translating some of the ideas and the context of what was happening into various Asian languages so that people who in our communities who don't speak English were able to understand what was happening. And I remember her talking a lot about how, you know, a lot of like Chinese elders would often show up for their indigenous neighbors in the downtown east side. And, you know, people don't talk about that or people stereotype, you know, people in Vancouver will talk about sort of quote unquote the racist stereotype of, you know, conservative, rich mm-hmm. Chinese people mm-hmm. and not realizing, you know, mm-hmm. how many Chinese people are living side by side with Indigenous people and Black people on the downtown east side, and they're showing up for each other. So, yeah, I like what you're saying, that these are bonds that already exist. It's just that we sometimes miss them or aren't taught about them, and we need to find what's there and strengthen it.
Yes, absolutely. And especially when we're talking about I was going to say like collaborations, but yeah, for lack of collabs mm-hmm. with the Black community and other racial groups, I think there's a clear reason why we're not taught that information. It's like anti-Blackness is rampant in other groups. So like, why would mm-hmm. they have conversations about why they were in solidarity with Black folks? Like, that's just, you know what I mean? Like, there's a reason why we're not taught that stuff. So once we know it, I think it just gives us more resolve to keep digging and finding more evidence of us, you know, not only like, like living and like working and growing like that existed in Hogan's Alley where there was like Indigenous communities living alongside Chinese communities, but also so much that we were learning about Central Park in New York, sorry, and Seneca Village. And I've just been like, I've seen a lot of information being shared that is like so interesting about how that was like the one space where Black folks were able to buy land, and that was connected to being able to vote. And then mm-hmm. like other information, like archaeological digs that have shown like other communities, Irish communities, Italian communities, that were all kind of like, they were all hanging out together, they were all living together. I think, yeah, I just wanted to say like the reason that we're not taught about that, those connection points between our groups, is because of anti-Blackness. And so if we're actively trying to resist and fight against anti-Blackness and hold up this idea that Black life is, that Black life matters, I think we have to reconcile with that reality too. Like, so much of this shit was intentionally withheld from us to make sure that, you know, we're not still absolutely. Like our own groups aren't being aligned with Blackness, because that is the worst thing of all time, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we talked about creative spaces, educational spaces. I think I really want to see us sharing sacred spaces as well and healing spaces. I think, again, this is where respecting boundaries comes back into it as well, because I think a lot of our healing practices and our sort of sacred, practices or traditions, sometimes when we're in deep relationship with each other, I've seen us want to share those things with each other, which I think is such an incredible, beautiful gift and one of the most powerful ways to build those really strong bonds. And with how rampant cultural appropriation is, we have to be able to trust each other to participate in the ways that we're invited to and not go beyond that, especially when it comes to these things that are sacred to us.
That's a really good point. I have never thought about that. And I think when you're talking about the sacred spaces, are you talking about like spiritual practices? Is that
spiritual practices and healing practices as well. And I've seen people be invited into that. Like in particular, I've seen in some contexts, Indigenous people being very generous of sharing, you know, gifting sage to somebody, for example, and telling them how to use it. And that, I think, when you are gifted that and invited to use that practice by somebody that you're in relationship with, again, such an incredibly powerful and beautiful gift. And that doesn't make it okay then for, you know, non-Indigenous people to be going and just deciding to buy sage, which, you know, is being very overconsumed by non-Indigenous people, which then makes it more difficult for Indigenous peoples who it's part of their lineage to use that in a way that's sacred. It's becoming like endangered because of over consumption and that kind of thing. So those are the kinds of things where if you're invited in, that's a beautiful gift and it's a beautiful way to be in deep relationship, but don't
abuse, you know, that.
Take that as license to abuse. Exactly.
Yes.
But I think when we're able to, I think like there's been so many sort of visions of like BIPOC healing spaces where we're able to come together and even like create sort of our own rituals because people are bringing different things from different cultures and traditions and sharing that. And then I think that just creates something that's so strong and powerful and can carry us through so much. And I think especially for those of us who are in diasporas, those of us who are, you know, queer and trans, who don't always have great access to our own cultural spaces in our own, you know, ethnic groups that we come from, being able to sort of create that in a chosen family way and to have people from all different backgrounds, that's such an incredible, beautiful thing. We just have to show it the respect and honor that it deserves by caring for each other with boundaries. Oh, and I also wanted to mention, yeah, taking interest in each other's holidays and each other's belief systems and each other's cultural icons. Again, like, not just showing up for the tragedies, which of course we should show up for, but we also want to show up and celebrate the good times together and experience joy together and get to know, you know, each other's, what each other's best days and most cherished days look like too. So for BIPOC of the week, I actually had two people I wanted to talk about. So it's so I wanted to honor Robin Maynard and Leanne Batasimasak Simpson. So they both individually are incredible people. Robin Maynard has an absolutely incredible foundational book called Policing Black Lives, State Violence in Canada from Slavery to the Present. And Leanne has a couple of books that I've read that are incredible. One is As We Have Always Done, Indigenous Freedom Through Radical Resistance. Also, Islands of Decolonial Love is a really beautiful book as well. But I wanted to honor them in this episode because of a lot of work that they do, but then specifically an essay in the book, Until We Are Free, Reflections on Black Lives Matter in Canada. So they did an essay together called Toward Black and Indigenous Futures on Turtle Island. And it's a really beautiful collaboration of looking at how intertwined the movements for Black and Indigenous liberation are, how powerful that solidarity is. And I don't know, it just, for me, it just really captured a lot of why we're doing this work and how transformative and radical and world-changing it is. So I would definitely recommend, I mean, everything that either one of them has been involved in is brilliant. But yeah, specifically this this book and this essay. So I just wanted to read a little excerpt that Leanne said in this little excerpt from something that Leanne said in the essay. So she said, "Reading Robin's book has led me and my thinking in a direction where I'm continually deepening this work for myself. When I write about Mishi's Sagig nationhood, I'm not talking about any Indigenous desire to be a nation state. I'm talking about dismantling the nation state. I'm thinking about how I can share space and land in deeply reciprocal and relational ways with freedom fighters and diasporic communities in a way that supports each of our sovereignties and self-determinations. And I'm thinking about what relational solidarity might be like within Anishinaabeg thought. I feel very, very grateful to the Black Lives Matter movement and also to Robin's book and to the contemporary radical Black art and scholarship that's happening right now and over the past several decades, because it challenges me to articulate my visions for an Indigenous future and Indigenous nationhood that categorically and unapologetically refuses white supremacy and challenges anti-Blackness in all its forms." So it's like, this is what is possible when we enter into deep relationship with each other, when we show up for each other in from the best times to the worst times and build solidarity. So definitely read this book, and thank you to Leanne and Robin for all of your incredible work.